WKOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes. All right. Hello, everybody. It's Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, about 8 minutes after 11 p.m. on the 2nd of April, 2007. Pleasure to be with you all tonight, and glad you're with me. All right. Thank you, first of all, to Debbie Johnson, as always. Free Range Radio Theater, 1 hour before this program. Debbie does it up. Great radio theater, and I love Debbie, and she does a great show right before this one. So check it out on the web, you know, or on the air, kopn.org or 89.5 FM, all right? Before Debbie, Kelvin and Jason doing it up. Jazz plus blues equals a new heaven and a new earth. Tech Radio before that, always keeping us up on the world of high tech. Jeff Wheeler starts things off on Monday with Uncommon Light, 3 to 5 p.m. every week, every Monday. Great radio right here on KOPN, your imagination station. Glad to be a part of it all. And thanks to everybody who participates with us, okay? And last week, of course, if you listened to the show and heard what we were talking about, we'll say thank you to Eric John Phelps, the author of Vatican Assassins. Pretty creepy stuff he's got to offer with regard to the Vatican, the Jesuit order, which plays, you know, such a prominent role in the policy and the you know, decision making of the church. Creepy stuff, man. You know, anyone who's paying attention knows the sordid history of this institution. So the historical precedent is a real one. No question about that. They've been very, very nasty people in the past. And it's the people, you know, not the institution. People talk about, you know, the Vatican said this, or the White House said this, or, you know, Nabisco said this, or ExxonMobil was... Corporations don't say anything. The Vatican doesn't say anything. It's a building. It's a city. A state, whatever the hell it is. Right? People say things. People say things. So, the people that have been involved in the institution of the Catholic Church for a long, long time, at the top levels of the hierarchy, have been involved in some very, very nasty business in the past. You know, that's no newsflash, or it shouldn't be. But, you know, is all of this still in place? And do they run the whole thing? I mean, are they really in control of the whole ball of wax, as Eric suggests? Who's to say? My own opinion, as you all know, my intuition is that they don't run the show. They simply think they do. But who's to say, you know? I have an inkling, though, that soon they will be aware of that fact, that the monkeys only think they're running the show, as Dennis always says. Anyhow, wild stuff for sure. Eric John Phelps, check him out on the web at VaticanAssassins.com, I guess, or .org, whatever. You can link there from my site. And we heard the great tunes of Mankind Liberation Front last week as well. So if you missed it, you can check it all out on the web, www.MikeHagan.com. And it's all there. All right? Check it out. Share it. Okay, tonight, Terrence McKenna, author, philosopher, my friend, an amazing speaker, plant biologist, ethnobotanist, an explorer of the mysterious and the unknown. I mean, like no one else I ever knew. And also a father and a brother and a man. And we'll talk about Terrence tonight. Let him do some talking of his own in just a bit. I've got a piece that will play at midnight, about 45 minutes from now, called True Hallucinations. And it's basically a personal account of the formative two-week period in the Amazon in 1971, which laid the path for all of the work, essentially, that Terrence did afterward, and to a great extent the work that Dennis, his brother, our friend, continues to do. I won't say more than that, but it's basically Terrence describing the experiences of the Amazon in 1971. It's an amazing book, if you haven't read it. It's called True Hallucinations, and we'll listen to Dennis and Terrence's story as told by Terrence in just a little while, okay? And let's see. What else do we do? Oh, music. Got a great band tonight. We're going to play on the program called Spangle. And you heard them just a few minutes earlier. The song was called When Shall I Be Free that we opened the show with. Spangle. More from them throughout the program tonight. They're a band from the UK and doing their own thing with independent work and distribution over the web, and quite popular, actually, you know, if you know where to find that stuff. But anyway, great stuff, and we'll hear more from them throughout the show tonight. They actually were fans of Terrence McKenna, is why I chose them to accompany the show tonight. They actually dedicated an album, their last album, to Terrence, as a matter of fact, I think. And if you want to find out more about them, you can go to Spangle, S-H-P-O-N-G-L-E, Spangle.org. All right? You can check them out there. On the they also have the whole MySpace thing going on. Right? Okay. Let's see. All right, one more time, the websites for the radio station, KOPN.org. And you can listen to the live stream from there if you're outside of the listening area, the traditional listening area, that is. And my website, MikeHagan, HAGAN.com. Okay? And if you're looking for music, there's a music archives there as well. So all that stuff is up there on the website. Just go there and snoop around, and you'll find some interesting stuff, okay? All right, good stuff on the way tonight, so stay in tune with me. We'll have another one here from Spangle. This one is called Smoked Glass and Chrome. Be back in just a few minutes. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.
Hi, everybody. Hello there. Got some good stuff here from Spangl. A lot of it's sort of lengthy, so I don't mind talking over a little bit of it. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. Hello to everyone out there listening to us on KOPN or over the web, live or otherwise. Every Monday, we broadcast a show, Radio Orbit, from the wonderful studios of KOPN, beautiful downtown Columbia, Missouri. And we stream the show live as well on the website, kopn.org. Just click on the Listen Live button. You'll get a nice 64K stream. And if you want something a little bit slower paced for lower bandwidth people out there, you can hop on over to Cosmic Waves Radio, cosmicwavesradio.com. We've got a 24K stream over there every Monday night. So thanks to everybody who makes it happen live, on the radio, and on the net. Thanks also to Larry, the web wizard, as always. Hope to have him back soon with us. He's on the way back to the islands, by the way. Congratulations to Larry. He's got a lot going on, but we expect to have him back with us as soon as possible. We all miss you a lot, Larry. Anyway, let's see. What else? Well, thanks to everybody out there who's been sending art, music, and poetry. I'll read a nice piece of poetry that Bob sent in from Jefferson City a little bit later. And there's new stuff in the Poets Corner. It's awesome. We love it. So send more. And we'll find a place for it on the web. Check it out, by the way. Let us know what you think. Okay, just hop on over there, MikeHagan.com, and you'll have access to everything we're doing. All right. So anyway, honestly, take a look and see. And let us know what you think. All right, let's see. What else happening tonight? All right, the chat room is up and active. Hello to everybody over there. There's a busy forum over at the website that's always interesting. Lots of topics being discussed over there. If you want to get a hold of me and share your thoughts directly, you can always do that via the website or email. My email address is orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T, radio, orbitradio, at AOL.com. And the website, of course, one more time, Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. And hello to everybody out there, actually, in the chat room. It's good to see everyone. And I also want to say a special little shout-out to Matthew from Ohio. Thanks for all the support, you guys. I appreciate it. You have no idea. All right, the phone number. Later on, we might take some calls after the true hallucinations piece. The phone number is 573-874-5676, but that's not the one you want. See, that's a trick. You have to be paying attention. 573-443-8255. If you want to call in later on, I'll open the phone lines up probably like 1 o'clock, a little bit after 1 o'clock. You're welcome to call in. Share your thoughts, comments, whatever, questions, okay? All right, tonight, like I said, something special for my friend, Terrence Kent McKenna, on the 3rd of April, the year 2000, 7 years ago tomorrow, he passed on. And I consider it a birthday as much as I do a death day. So happy birthday to my friend Terrence. And he was a wonderful guy and had a lot of good things to say. We'll share some of that with you tonight. Actually, his personal story of what launched him on an amazing life, adventure, and career. And for those of you unfamiliar, he has a younger brother named Dennis, who is a brilliant neurochemist, plant biologist, ethnopharmacologist, who is up there in Vancouver now at the British Columbia Institute of Technology. I spoke with Dennis on Wednesday, last Wednesday, and we both were just boggled, you know, by the fact that, you know, it's been 7 years since Terrence took off. But he's still with us. And he speaks really clearly and really loud to this day. So we'll let him do that some of his own words. And just a little bit longer here, in about a half an hour or so, Terrence McKenna. And he'll talk about his book, True Hallucinations. Okay? Next week, the Bard, Kent Stedman, on the 9th of April. www.cyberspaceorbit.com, of course, if you're familiar with this program, you'll be familiar with Kent Stedman, my good friend, mentor, and just a wonderful guy doing some amazing creative stuff on the web at cyberspaceorbit.com. Richard Allen Miller, interesting fellow that I've run across in the last couple of weeks, thanks to my friend Ian. And he'll be on the program sometime soon, not sure exactly when, probably end of April. B. Wilson, we'll try to get in touch with her and talk about honeybees, what's happening with the honeybee populations, a mysterious thing happening, not just in the United States, but all around the planet with regard to honeybees. There's plenty over at my place, by the way. Everything's cool over there. Patrick Flanagan. We'll see. I'm just trying to work out a date with Dr. Patrick Flanagan. Paul Laffoley, back by popular demand on the 21st of May. And that was an astonishing show, by the way, that we did with Paul Laffoley. What was it? February 17th, 12th? I don't know. Whatever it was. Check it out. Check out what he had to say about 9/11, by the way. Send it to Rosie O'Donnell or something. Gary David, he wrote a book called Orion and the Hopi. I need to get a hold of David. He's been trying to call me, and we just haven't gotten in touch yet. But anyway, that'll be a fun show. Gary David, the connection between the constellation Orion and the Hopi people down there in Arizona. Dr. Richard Tarnas, the author of Cosmos and Psyche, also the author of Passion of the Western Mind. Susan Weed, on the 16th, actually. I think that's what we have for the 16th of April. Susan Weed. Yeah. She's wonderful. Susan, SusanWeed.com. SusanWeed.com, if you want to check her out. All right, lots of other stuff in the wing, if you know what I'm saying. Music tonight, Spangl. We had Mankind Liberation Front last week. I got this great CD from Marcy Playground recently. I might play for you. I'll save that for July, though. It's going to be my July 4th special, I think. Anyway, lots of good stuff happening, and thanks to everyone who's been sharing their stuff with us and sending music and putting me in contact with great artists, and I really appreciate it, okay? All right, let's see. It is about 11:30. Tonight we're going to talk about Terrence McKenna. He was born on November 16th, 1946, died April 3rd, 2000, writer, philosopher, ethnobotanist, plant biologist, turned revolutionary psychedelic advocate and sort of a spokesperson for the underground art scene and psychedelia. Anyway, he was amazing, and I miss him dearly. But like I say, you know, he's floating around there. Just look up in the sky once in a while. You know, maybe tonight's a good night to do that, actually. Maybe he'll show us a sign. Anyway, we'll play a piece called True Hallucinations from Terrence in about a half an hour. Another person I'd like to mention tonight is Rudolf Steiner. Rudolf Steiner was a Croatian, actually, who was known primarily as an Austrian, though, although he was born in Croatia. But he was a writer and a total scholar, another one of these polymaths. We've been talking about a lot of these people that are just extremely talented in many different fields and recognized as such. Rudolf Steiner, one of these people, a philosopher, scholar of many, many different fields, educator, artist, playwright, and a guy that wrote a lot about social situations. And he was interested in the esoteric as well. He founded this, I don't know what you want to call it, a philosophy, I guess, that was called Anthroposophy. Essentially, it's a lot like Gnosticism, essentially, to follow, you know, a path of knowledge and let knowledge guide the spirit. One of the main tenets of this particular point of view is experience, you know, personal experience. They put a lot of value on that as opposed to, you know, just believing what was handed down or laid down as a dictate from above, or something that you read in a book that somebody else just told you, you know. So, anyway, Rudolf Steiner, born in 1861, February 25th, he died March 30th, 1925. And there's another thing that Steiner did that was wonderful. He introduced a system of education called Waldorf education. And I think there's actually a Waldorf school that's going to open in Columbia, or thinking about it here, but please, it would be wonderful. If you have young children, look in your area, if you're interested in this thing, for a Waldorf school. go on the web and check out Rudolf Steiner, and you know, you can find information about this particular type of education. And in my opinion, it's a wonderful way to teach children. Basically teaches them how to learn. You know, it doesn't teach them how to recite, you know, horse crap from a book. Anyway, Rudolf Steiner, amazing guy. And one other thing I'll add about Rudolf Steiner, that he was a big believer in the human heart as much more than a pump. And Steiner did a tremendous amount of work with regard to the heart and how it was involved in cognition, that it was actually an instrument of thought. And he was right. And still yet to be recognized as such, but, you know, whether you recognize it or not, it's a true thing that's happening. So, here's to him, Rudolf Steiner, Terence Kemp McKenna. I love you both. Space weather. Keep your eyes on the skies. There's an egg moon tonight. The full moon of April. In folklore, it's called an egg moon. Try to find out why. It's nearly impossible. That's why I don't know. I think it probably has something to do with the springtime and the renewal of the life cycle. And an egg, you know, essentially about to crack open. Start something brand new. Like the crack in the cosmic egg that Joseph Chilton Pierce wrote about. Of course, he was so influenced by Rudolf Steiner. But anyway, tonight, the full egg moon. Check it out if you got clear skies. It's amazing. Beautiful, beautiful out tonight in Colombia. Probably 80 degrees today, perfectly clear skies. And just a lovely spring day. All right? So go up there, take a look at the moon. Maybe get some ideas for decorating your silly Easter eggs. You can put those cracked shells to some good use, finally. All right. Aurora Borealis. There was a solar wind stream that came in contact with the Earth on April 1st. No joke. A mild but beautiful geomagnetic storm. There's some nice photos from up in Alaska that you can see on the website of spaceweather.com. And more auroras possible tonight, for sure. Earth is still inside that stream, and a good gust of solar breath could spark another beautiful display. So if you're up north there, keep your eyes on the skies. Keep your eyes on the skies everywhere tonight. You never know what you'll see in the sky, says this other guy. This guy taking pictures out in California, speaking of strange things, and up there in the blue sky is a picture of a face. Somebody flew around in a circle, and then put two eyes, a nose, and a smiling face up there in the sky. So, you know, I guess it was the April Fool's joke of the day. Now, speaking of strange things in the sky, the reason I keep talking about this, last night I saw something very strange in the sky. And I don't know what it was, but in, you know, I live in this place called Rocheport, Missouri, and I was outside walking around at about 11 o'clock. My family's out of town right now. And I was just going for a walk, took my dogs out. And off to the south, pretty much directly south, maybe 10, 15 degrees above the horizon, I saw something in the sky. And it was different lights flashing green, red, blue in a pattern, and sort of a circular pattern. It was moving around sequentially, the way the lights lit up, you know, sort of like a one of those, you know, those signs that have like moving text on them or whatever. It's like that or something. But anyway, it was weird, and sort of said hello. I wasn't scared of it. I mean, it was a long way away or anything, but, and I couldn't see it clearly. I don't know, you know, I'm not saying it was anything in particular, but it was strange. I'd never seen, you know, anything particularly like this. I've looked up the skies for a long, long time. And it came closer, actually, and was definitely rotating. Something was sort of rotating. And then just moved off to, let's see, if you make a left and you're going south, to the east. And it was just sort of, you know, floating, man, just cruising, and it's pretty slowly. But just floated away, and that was it. And, you know, it got closer for a while, and then just took off. But anyway, it was very cool and weird. But true story. And I don't know what it means, and I don't know what it was. I don't claim to say, I don't know what the hell it was. All right? But I don't think that it was a typical aircraft. It sure didn't seem like it to me. So, but I'm a skeptic for the most part. I try to be a rationalist about this stuff. But, I mean, with my own eyes, I saw something. I don't know what it was. And I don't claim to know what it was, but it was something strange. Maybe that's why they call them UFOs, because they're unidentified. And I guess that's all it was. For me, it was unidentified. If somebody can identify it, or if anybody else saw something strange like that, it'd be interesting to know. So, anyway, keep looking up. All right? Okay. It is about 20 minutes until midnight. And I want to pay. I want to play a piece of audio from our friend Joseph Campbell. I mentioned him last week, and I was sort of short on time last week, and didn't have a chance to play anything by him. But tonight I do, and it's a pretty short piece here, about 4 minutes long. But it's Joseph Campbell from a series that he did with Bill Moyers back in, I think, 1988. Shortly before his death, and it was 86, I forget, whatever. Anyway, this one is called Going to Death as a God. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We'll be back in about 4 minutes.
This idea of sacrifice is so foreign to our world today.
Well, the old idea of being sacrificed is not what we think at all. Just consider, I think the great model of sacrifice is the Mayan Indian ball game. You know, they had a kind of basketball game. It was a loop there up in the stadium wall, and the idea was to get this big, heavy ball through that. I don't know how they did it with their shoulders or heads or something or other. And the captain of the winning team was sacrificed on the field by the captain of the losing team. His head was cut off. And going to your sacrifice as the winning stroke of your life is the essence of the early sacrificial idea. There's a wonderful story that I found in the Jesuit Relations. You know, the Jesuits here in the 17th century as missionaries up in Canada and northern New York State and so forth, of a young Iroquois boy who had just been captured by the Hurons, or perhaps it was the other way around, I've forgotten. And he was being brought to be tortured to death. The Northeast Indians engaged in a systematic torture, which would go on for a long time, and the ordeal was to be sustained with a smile without flinching. That was it. That was real manhood. But the boy is brought to this as though he were being brought to his wedding. He is singing, and the people with him are treating him as though they were his hosts, and he was the honored guest, and he played the game with them, knowing where he was going. And the priests describing the thing are absolutely bewildered by the situation. And they say that the mockery of this kind of hospitality for people who are then going to become the brutes. No, those people were the priests. And this was the sacrifice of the altar. And that boy was Jesus, you know, by analogy. And the priest every day is celebrating Mass, which is an imitation or repetition, actually, of the sacrifice of the cross. That's what this priest was witnessing. But then you have it also in the Acts of John, Jesus before going to crucify, the Jesus dance. That's one of the most beautiful passages in the Christian tradition. In the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John Gospels, it certainly mentioned that we sang a hymn and Jesus went forth. Well, here you have the whole hymn described in a ring. Jesus in the center saying, join hands and we'll sing and we'll dance. And he says, I am this, I am that, I am so forth, so forth. Amen, amen. Oh, my God, it's grand. And then he walks out to be crucified. When you go to your death that way as a God, you are going to your eternal life. What's sad about that? Let's make it great. And they do.
The God of death is the Lord of the dance.
The God of death is the Lord of sex at the same time.
What do you mean?
It's a marvelous thing. One after another, you can see these gods. Gay Day, the god of the death god of the Haitian voodoo, is also the sex god. Votan, had one eye covered and the other uncovered, you see? And at the same time was the Lord of life. Osiris, the Lord of death and the Lord of the generation of life. It's a basic thing. That which dies is born. You have to have death in order to have life.
That's right. All right. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Got a couple of announcements here for you before we get on with things. We'll play another piece of music here in a minute. But first, a couple things, all right? Keep it quiet. We're going to try to cancel the May 2007 on-air membership drive. And the way we're going to do that is try to get people to donate early during our Keep It Quiet campaign. If we reach our goal of $30,000, we'll keep it quiet. We won't say anything on the air. We'll cancel the May on-air campaign. But in order to do that, we need your help. You can call, make your donation today online at kopn.org or by mail, 915 East Broadway, Columbia, Missouri, 65201. All right, we appreciate the help that we get from anyone. And it's a time when we really need help because institutions like ours ain't very popular these days, if you haven't noticed. World Woman, KOPN's World Woman, with the financial assistance of the City of Columbia Department of Cultural Affairs, is proud to air an interview with Lizelle Mueller while she was visiting poet in residence here at the University of Missouri. Lizelle will be reading and discussing the origins of her poems and the importance of language and poetry. That's Sunday, April 8th, 5 p.m. on World Woman, only on KOPN 89.5 FM. Okay, streaming on the web, kopn.org. All right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Let's play a piece of music here from Spangl. And then we'll come back, and I think we'll start this piece from Terrence in just a few minutes here. It's about 70 minutes long, so I think we'll play it straight through, and so we'll start at about 10 till. It'll finish off at about 1 o'clock, and then we'll talk on the phones or do whatever after that. Okay, I'm sure there's some stuff in the news we can go take a look at, whatever. Okay, this one, first of all, is a song called Mentalism. All right, Spangl on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. everybody. That's Spangl. And it's Mike. You're listening to KOPN Radio Orbit, 89.5 FM, on the web at kopn.org. And it's about 10 minutes to midnight on the 2nd of April, almost the 3rd of April, 2007. And we're going to do a little special tribute to my friend Terrence McKenna. If you don't know him, listen up. Hang on, Hannah, as he used to say. All right? We'll come back in a little while. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. And this is True Hallucinations, a remarkable true story that happened to my friend Terrence McKenna 36 years ago. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. KOPN Columbia. We'll be back in a little while.
Anyway, I think all of you know who he is, so I'm just going to turn this over to him. Terrence McKenna.
Can everybody hear? Good. Well, it's great to be here. It's always fun to come to the West Side and see the usual suspects all assembled. I'm here to flog a new book. It seems like they're coming out about once a year, and that will continue on into next year. The object of attention at the moment is True Hallucinations, and I'm very up for this because my other books were basically speculation, philosophy, ideas, art historical comment on psychedelics, so forth and so on. This is autobiography, narrative. It has action, heartbreak, erotic outrage, climax, denouement, all those good literary type things. And I wrote it basically because a lot of people have said it seemed to them incomprehensible how my brother and I got to where we are in terms of the way in which we've furnished our heads. And this is basically the story of the formative 2 weeks in our lives. In 1971, I was 23. My brother was 19. I'd spent several years in Asia already, having been run out of Berkeley because of the revolution. And we were graduates of the LSD revolution, but it had left us wanting more, specifically wanting the kinds of experiences that the classical commentators on psychedelics described. And by that I mean people like Havelock Ellis in The Dance of Life, or S. Weir Mitchell, who wrote about mescaline. LSD for us never delivered visions. It delivered insight and feelings and complex thoughts, but not visions, not activity in the visual cortex that these classical commentators had led us to expect. And I had been in India for a number of years and pretty well managed to convince myself that whatever spirituality had ever been there, it had evaporated thousands of years ago, and that what we were left with was a very grasping and mendacious priestly hierarchy that was about as cynical as religion gets. And I was raised Catholic, so I know what I'm talking about. And so then we decided, well, where the gnosis must be is in the Amazon, where we knew there was a pristine Aboriginal shamanism based on hallucinogens. And I stress our youth, because I think people imagine that you can only make contributions if you're old and laden with degrees and that sort of thing. And basically, our pure, reckless inventiveness carried us further into the heart of the mystery than I would ever have believed possible. And I should say a little bit about the method, because I think it's important. rationalism in confrontation with the weird edges is what's always worked for me. In other words, if you're a true believer, if you have some prepackaged philosophy, then you're going to miss a great deal because you're pre-programmed to ignore what doesn't fit into your model. And it doesn't matter what your model is. But if you are simply the open-minded skeptic slash witness, and then if you push at the edges of the phenomenal world, you know, go to the highest mountains, the oldest cities, the deepest deserts, the most remote jungles, and just simply put yourself in these circumstances, the cosmic giggle can get at you. You know, it can't get at you if you're pursuing your job delivering messages for Matthew and Son or whatever it is you've got going. But if you will tear the human atom of your individuality out of the collectivity and set yourself into a wilderness, a desert, an uninhabited island, then this thing can rise out of the depths and communicate if it chooses, shape your life, for sure, blow your mind. And there's almost a kind of unconsciousness, which is the precondition for success in this area. When you are superbly educated and completely alert to all possibilities and scanning the horizon for action, this is the equivalent of watching a pot to wait for it to boil. It won't happen. It's when you become preoccupied, broke, a touch of dysentery, a little confusion in the mix, and then it can sink its teeth into you. So I thought Harper, who published this and I think did a beautiful job with the production of it, has informed me that I, by joining up with them, am no more the cheerful, extemporaneous ad lib artist of the past, that I have been elevated into the high and holy realm of being a litterateur. And what that means is you have to read. And it's not really my métier, but it pleases them no end back where they cut the checks. So I will, in fact, read to you from my new book. And I should say a bit about our goal. You can't just willy-nilly head off to sit in the desert. You have to have an agenda, however flimsy and based on misinformation. The agenda tells you what you're supposed to do next. So our agenda was, we had been interested, as I'm sure many of you have been and are, in the psychedelic flash that accompanies DMT, which is extraordinarily brief. It's like a minute and a half, 2 minutes tops. And we had the notion that if you could get in there for a half an hour, you might be able to bring back something really astonishing for the rest of the gang to puzzle over. Of course, you might leave your mind behind in the process, but, you know, nothing is for sure, right? So it turned out that Richard Evans Schultes, the great doyen of psychedelic botany, had reported a few years ago a psychedelic plant complex called Ukuhe, which was used by a dwindling tribe of Indians called Witoto. And it was orally active. It was a little pill that they made out of the resin of a tree. And the literature insisted that they used this Ukuhe to speak with little men. Well, you can imagine the effect that had on us. I mean, after all, speaking with little men is something that's very dear to our hearts, hardly to speak of speaking with little women. So we set off for the Amazon to contact this Indian tribe, to try and see if we couldn't persuade them to reveal how they made this stuff, or at least to score from them if all else failed. And what this meant then, in practical terms, was going to a place called La Chorrera. You like that. Choro is a funny word in Spanish. It's not exactly a waterfall. It's not that steep. It's where a river goes at about a 45 or steeper. Colloquially, it refers to the angle of the dangle on male liquid evacuation, is I think the proper way to put it. So a choro is a stream at a 45-degree angle that's moving very rapidly. And this place, La Chorrera, about which we knew practically nothing except these Indians were there, turned out not to be your ordinary anonymous jungle mission out there in the big green. It turned out this place had a hellacious history attached to it because it was the place from which the Putumayo rubber boom was administered. Not very many people know or recall that before Waco, before Tel Zaatar, before Auschwitz, before Guernica, before Armenia, before these great episodes and spasms of extinction in the 20th century, it was all rehearsed between 1912 and 17 in the Peruvian Amazon when British banks bankrolled essentially Peruvian mafias to wage a war of terror on these Indians, and the issue was rubber for the World War. This was before synthetic rubber had been invented, and these Indians were told, you bring in X number of kilos of rubber per month, and whatever you fall below your quota, that weight in your own flesh will be removed by machete. And these Indians went from 45,000 to 3,500 by the time we got there. So in spite of this beautiful climaxed rainforest, and we were actually moving through a landscape of ghosts and catastrophe. And when you would walk these jungle trails in the afternoon with the sunlight slanting in, you would swear you could hear the footfalls of manacled feet and low voices conversing. I mean, it was a very strange place. So, here's a picture of it. Most of the Amazon basin is made up of alluvial deposits from the Andes. La Chorrera is different. A river, the Agara Paraná, flows and into a crack. It becomes very rapid, then drops over an edge, a lip, creating not exactly a waterfall, but a narrow channel of water, a flume whose violent outpouring has made a sizable lake. La Chorrera is a paradisical place. You push very hard and suddenly you are there. There are no stinging or biting insects. In the evening, mist drifts across a large pasture, creating a beautiful pastoral scene. There is the mission, the foam-flecked lake below, the jungle surrounding, and much to my surprise, white cattle. The afternoon following our arrival, at the edge of the pasture, which had been cleared by the Spanish priests who had managed Mission La Chorrera since its establishment in the 20s, I held and turned over in my hand perfect specimens of the same species of mushroom I had eaten near Florencia just a week or two before. In the pasture before me were dozens of these mushrooms. After examining several, my brother concurred, pronounced them the same Stropharia cubensis we had found before, one of the largest, strongest, and certainly most widely distributed of any of the known psilocybin mushrooms. What to do? We had no data on the proper dosage of psilocybin. Our expedition's thinned-down drug and plant file was concerned with flowering plants, not fungi. Collectively, we seem to remember that in the Oaxacan mushroom ritual described by Gordon Wasson, mushrooms were always eaten in pairs. with several pears consumed, we determined to eat 6 mushrooms each that same evening. And then here is my journal entry for this day, February 23rd, 1971. Are we indeed now in some way camped on the edge of another dimension? Yesterday afternoon, Dave discovered Stropharia cubensis in the damp pastures behind the house where we had hung our hammocks. He and I gathered 30 delicious psilocybin-saturated specimens in about half an hour. We each ate 6 and spent last night on an enormously rich and alive, yet gentle and elusive trip. In between strange lights in the pasture and discussion of our project, I am left with the sense that by penetrating the local psychedelic flora this way, we have taken a giant step toward deeper understanding. Multifaceted and benevolent, as complex as mescaline, as intense as LSD, the mushroom, as is said at peyote, teaches the right way to live. This particular mushroom species is unclaimed, so far as I know, by any Aboriginal people anywhere, and thus is neutral ground in the tryptamine dimension we are exploring. Through this unclaimed vegetable teacher, one can gain entry into the world of the elf chemists. The experience of the mushroom is subtle, but can reach out to the depth and breadth of a truly intense psychedelic experience. It is, however, extremely mercurial and difficult to catch at work. Dennis and I, through a staggered description of our visions, noticed a similarity of content that seemed to suggest a telepathic phenomenon or some sort of simultaneous perception of the same invisible landscape. A tight headache accompanied the experience in its final stages, but this was quick to fade, and the body strain and exhaustion often met with in unextracted vegetable drugs was not present. The mushroom is a transdimensional doorway which sly fairies have left slightly ajar for anyone to enter into who can find the key and who wishes to use this power, the power of vision, to explore this peculiar and naturally occurring psychoactive complex. We are closing distance with the most profound event a planetary ecology can encounter, the emergence of life from the dark chrysalis of matter. That was after one trip, you know. I got it, and the lock began to tighten. So then much of the rest of the story, with a few flashbacks and some philosophical musing on the content, deals with a series of ideas which Dennis began to develop based around the question, do you know what we could do with this stuff? And then he proceeded to answer his own question. And he had an idea, which I do confess I find rather hard to put out in 10 minutes and feel that I've done an adequate job. That's what the book is for. I think in the 10-minute version, it sounds fascinating but preposterous. In the book, I think we make it fascinating and entirely credible. And the concept was he seemed to have gotten a very deep connection into this logos-like gnosis conveying force in the mushroom, and it began talking about how you could use this thing to essentially give birth to your own soul as a physical object. You know, we all have a mind or a soul, but it's an invisible organ. It isn't like your left hand or your nose. We never see it, and we don't know whether it's in the brain or it surrounds the body, but it's very real to us. We think with it. So he was suggesting that there is a way to, and some of you have heard me say this in the past, that we need to turn the body inside out, make the soul visible, make the body something commanded in the imagination. Well, he took this as a set of engineering specs and set to work to figure out how to do it. And the method is given in here. I had to arm wrestle Harper fairly strenuously because they said, you know, these notes of your brothers, I mean, they're overstated, scientifically specious, riddled with the incomprehensible, so forth and so on. I said, yes, but it worked. And driven by the thought that there may be someone who will read this book who is far smarter than Dennis or I, then all the details must be here. If you want to read it as an adventure story, that's fine. You just skip over Dennis's notebook entries. But if you see it as a recipe book, then that's where you want to place your attention. So he became very highly agitated and irascible and just obsessed by this idea of this experiment to condense the mind, give birth to the soul, emanatize the eschaton, call down the flying saucers, fuse spirit with matter, create the universal panacea at the end of time, and lead a triumphant humanity into hyperspace, or something like that. And my attitude was, hell, there's no swerving him from this. He can talk of nothing else. So let's just cut to the chase and do the damn experiment, and surely nothing will happen. And then we can, you know, he can make of that what he wishes, and the rest of us will go back to botanizing, trying to get tight with these Indians and push forward this program to get this DMT thing. Because essentially the presence of these mushrooms has totally overturned our original agenda. Well, then he performed the experiment, and to the point that he performed the experiment, I had been what I thought of as the indulgent, fair-minded witness. He performed the experiment and promptly went bananas. He had said before that he might experience what he called a psychic reversal. But I had just, you know, he'd said a lot of things going into this, and I hadn't weighed it that heavily. Within minutes of finishing this experiment, it became clear that not only was he highly agitated and raving constantly, but he also didn't seem to be able to hear other people. He talked right through people. And when you would point out to him that this was an incredibly rude thing to do, then there would just be a huge amount of confusion and apologizing, and he seemed genuinely not to be able to hear other people and was raving constantly. Meanwhile, at the moment the experiment was performed, I, who had to this point just been sort of playing along, it was as though he reached into my deepest plumbing and he just threw a switch, and this channel opened, and it began to inform me. It was not like any drug I've ever taken. It was not like any experience I'd ever had. There was no hallucination. What there was what I would describe as pure understanding. Understanding that amplified itself every hour, every minute. I mean, I had only to take a cup and dip up a glass of water from the spring and pour it past my eyes, and I could say, I understand water. Or pick up a leaf and look at it and have some kind of huge, wordless, but very emotionally deep understanding of the ecosystem, the jungle, the connections to the planet. I mean, it seemed to me that I was very close to what looked like enlightenment of some sort. I mean, just an ability to be absolutely at peace, fully in the moment, and just everything became a teacher. Everything was able to communicate to me its essence. But what was bringing me down in this situation was that Dennis's condition was creating a huge wave of accusation and confusion in our small expedition. Some people thought he should be airlifted to a hospital. Other people thought we should simply wait for him to ascend into heaven. And it's hard to reconcile that kind of thing, you know. And many, many strange things went on, and I'll give you a flavor of our psychology at this time. The day after the experiment, or the evening following the experiment was done sometime around dawn in the early morning hours of March 5th, 1971. The evening of March 5th, we all hung our hammocks together in this hut, and I got up in the middle of the night to take a leak because of the condensed milk that you have to drink when you're an explorer. And I checked everybody out, and everybody seemed to be sleeping soundly, and then I lay in my hammock a long, long time, and everything seemed peaceful and still. But as breakfast unfolded the following morning, the 6th of March, the morning after this, it became clear that the restful sleep I had imagined we had all shared had been anything but that. From Dennis, still disorganized but expansive, comments emerged that he had, or imagined he had, a very active night. Upon close questioning, it came out that he was completely convinced that sometime during the night, he had arisen and dressed, and then in a series of nocturnal adventures, and then had a series of nocturnal adventures. These involved going alone in the darkness to the thundering immensity of the Choro over a mile away, then returning to climb and spend some time in a large tree near the edge of the mission, then making his way back across the pasture and returning to his hammock strung among all the others. The thought of him wandering around during the night on those trails without his glasses, which he had thrown away in the first minutes after the experiment. He announced that they were no longer necessary and had just flung them away. He also had thrown away all of his clothes and methodically smashed everybody's watch. Without his glasses, falling in and out of shamanic ecstasy, perhaps howling and otherwise paleolithically comporting himself, was too much for me. It was a breach of the collective cool, even though I was 90% certain that it had never really happened. I was determined to eliminate all possibility of such rambles in the future. Dennis's story was the classic description of a shamanic night journey. He said that he had gone to the Choro and had meditated in the mission cemetery we had visited before. He had begun to return to the camp when he confronted a particularly large Enga tree near where the path skirted the edge of the mission. On impulse, he had climbed it, aware as he did that the ascent of the world tree is the central motif of the Siberian shamanic journey. As he climbed the tree, he felt the flickering polarities of many archetypes, and as he reached the highest point in his ascent, something that he called the vortex opened ahead of him, a swirling, enormous doorway into time. He could see the cyclopean megaliths of Stonehenge, and beyond them, revolving at a different speed and at a higher plane, the outlines of the pyramids, gleaming and marble-faceted as they have not been since the days of pharaonic Egypt. And yet further into the turbulent maw of the vortex, he saw mysteries that were ancient long before the advent of man, titanic archetypal forms on worlds unimagined by us, the arcane machineries of sentient agencies that swept through this part of the galaxy when our planet was young and its surface barely cooled. This machinery, these gibbering abysses touched with the cold of interstellar space and aeon-consuming time, rushed down upon him. He fainted, and time, who can say how much, passed him by. So this is the kind of stuff we were dealing with. And my point in writing the book, I mean, there are many stories of people going bananas, and then there are many stories where there's a very radical break with reality, and you either have to believe it or not believe it. And I'm thinking of Carlos Castaneda, Whitley Strieber. I mean, after all, proctological examinations carried out in your bedroom by gray-faced aliens from another world, that's a pretty radical break with my reality. But here it rides the edge, because this is a true story. It is, to the best of my ability, unembellished. But it argues that guys like Strieber and Castaneda actually do have their finger on something. It is rare to violate the laws of physics and, you know, universal expectation based on experience, but it's not impossible. It happened to us. There were several things that can be isolated out of our story that simply secure answers to certain questions that people have asked since time immemorial. For example, we had telepathic experiences that absolutely satisfy me that under some conditions, one person can not only penetrate another person's thought, but what he did was much more spectacular than that. He penetrated into my memory. He was able to talk about things that had happened to me that I had never told him about and that I was not consciously thinking about. So it was as though somehow our minds had become fused. There were numerous other things. Unfortunately, there isn't time to get into all of this. But the point is, and I started out by saying this, rationalism and the investigation of the unusual with a fair and open mind is the working prescription for securing for yourself that the world is stranger than we can suppose, and certainly stranger than science can suppose, certainly stranger than the cultural myths that we are living under dare to suppose. And I don't know where all this goes, you know, because this story happened to real people, every single one of whom is still alive as we speak. There was no happily ever after, except in the sense that the Logos promised that the point of view, I guess is the way to put it, would spread, would become generalized. And when I recall that in 1971 I was penniless, wanted by Interpol, careerless, and, you know, pretty much the Amazon was the end of the line for me. I spent all my money going in to La Charrera. I did not have a clue. I was at the end of my rope. And now this strange meme based on psilocybin, elf machines in hyperspace, the collapse of the vectors of history in 2012, the whisperings from the transmundane other, this whole thing that we've released seems to be sustaining itself, basically because of people like you, because somehow we're all part of this story. I really believe that this is about a discovery of some sort, so huge that we can't even put a name to it. I mean, Columbus could say, I found land. And Galileo could say, there are mountains on the moon. Is it then for me to say there are elves inside our head, our collective head, and that somehow this is going to have an impact? I'm convinced of it, that it is for a purpose, that the entire ecology of the planet is attempting to communicate ever more exotic messages to us as the culture crisis deepens. And it's too much for one person or one small group of people to try to come to terms with. It has to be laid before the bar of public opinion. and people have to deal with this in the context of their own psychedelic experiences and their own hopes and fears. And perhaps, you know, if this is done and we can reach a consensus, then we may well discover that the hallucinations that have prompted us into religion and art and music and mathematics over millennia of time actually were true hallucinations all the time. Well, that's all I have to say about that. I'll answer some questions, and I understand you're going to read them?
Yep.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Somehow I think you wrote this one.
I wrote it?
No. It sounds like something you would write. Is the TV computer satellite that surrounds the whole planet have a collective psychedelic effect on the world population? Are psychedelics a mirror of this, or an antidote, or an anesthetic to the environment?
Why do you think I would ask a question?
I don't know. Well, it's a wording, I guess.
I don't know. I mean, in a sense, it seems to me that what's happening is in our minds and outside our minds, if there is an outside our minds, but in the three-dimensional space of culture, we're undergoing an informational revolution of some sort. All data is rising to the surface. 9 million computers a month are being connected into networks worldwide at the very moment that some unknown number of people, because we can't get data on this, are taking psychedelics per month. And clearly, the thing that is unique about us as a species is that we have made much of information. You know, ants have scripted it down into a few pheromonal signals. Coyote packs have a kind of a pre-language. You can make what you wish of the dolphins and the whales. But no species has ever grabbed on to information the way we have. And I believe that history is a self-limiting process, that we are coming to the end of it, that business as usual has been taken off the menu. And that if you take all these curves, the curve of petroleum extraction, the curve of the spread of epidemic diseases, the curve of the dissolution of the ozone hole, the curve of the rise of global population, if you plot all these curves together, you reach the conclusion that sometime in the second decade of the next century, the contradictions become so excruciating that the entire thing is going to be forced into some kind of phase transition. It may be extinction, it may be a planetary Bosnia, or it could be something positive. But business as usual is off the menu. And the psychedelics connect you up to this looming event, because we are now, having journeyed toward it for at least 10,000 years, we're less than 20 years away from it. So it is imminent in every sense of the word. And to contact it, all you have to do is close your eyes, smoke a bomber, eat a mushroom, sit in yoga for a moment. I mean, it is very, very near. The energy threshold between us and the transcendental object is very, very thin. And that's why things are so peculiar, because the architecture of our collective lives and the architecture of our individual lives have fallen under the domain of a kind of attractor. And this is the attractor which, when it penetrated into our primate ancestors, it drew out of a higher animal ourselves. We are literally being sculpted on a scale of a million years. An animal species, some kind of advanced monkey, is being turned into the carrier for a projection from the transmundane that leaves us with one foot in the primate world and one foot firmly planted in the angelic world. We are a species in the process of being alchemically transformed by the other, and we can't know what that means for ourselves, for the fate of the planet. It is an absolute mystery. It is the mystery of our own becoming. I don't know if that was the answer to the question, but...
The Supreme Court...
Picky.
The Supreme Court has ruled against the Native American Church use of peyote. How will this impact other people's use of the sacrament?
Well, not at all, I hope.
Yeah.
Progress of human civilization in the area of defining human freedom is not made from the top down. No king, no government, no parliament ever extended to the people more rights than the people insisted upon. And I think we've come to a place with this psychedelic thing, and we have the gay community as a model, and all the other communities, the ethnic communities. We simply have to say, look, LSD has been around for 50 years now. We just celebrated the birthday. It ain't going away. We are not going away. We are not slack-jawed, dazed, glazed, unemployable, psychotic creeps. We are pillars of society. You can't run your computers, your fashion houses, your publishing houses, your damn magazines. You can't do anything in culture without psychedelic people in key positions. And this is the great unspoken truth of American creativity. And so I think it's time basically to come out of the closet and just say, you know, I'm stoned and I'm proud. So if that's a problem for you, you got a problem, fella. Yeah.
Talk about hemp and its possibilities for our future.
Hemp, yes. Well, this is interesting. You all know the basic pitch for hemp, and I wouldn't be what I am if it weren't for cannabis. I think, and I want to see it legalized, although I'm very, very skeptical. I don't think the people who want it legalized have fairly confronted what it really is. The argument is twofold, as I understand it, for legalizing hemp. Is number one, a lot of money could be made off all these wonderful cloths and products and lubricants and so and medicines and so forth. And the other argument relates to its psychoactivity, and the argument made there is it's no big deal. Well, I actually think it is somewhat of a big deal. And I think the people who don't want to see it legalized see it that way. Cultures are shaped by the drugs that they take and that they suppress. We are a sugar, red meat, and alcohol culture primarily, with tobacco and alcohol to shore all that up. Think for a minute about a drug like coffee, caffeine. Every labor contract in Western civilization contains a clause which secures the worker's right to halt the assembly line twice a day to fuel up on a drug known to cause liver damage and all kinds of problems. Well, now, why isn't there a cannabis break? The reason is that caffeine perfectly fits in to a program that would have you busily screwing widgets onto wonkets and moving them along the assembly line. In other words, it promotes capitalist values, performing repetitious tasks in a state of sort of glazed acceptance. Cannabis, on the other hand, what is always said about it? Makes you inefficient. lazy, uninterested in earning your Mercedes and your house.
Fighting a war.
Yeah. So I think that if we could, I'm very interested in this cannabis thing. I think it may be the wedge through which we can push the whole psychedelic agenda. But I guarantee you, if it's legalized, it will be a tremendous big deal, because cannabis promotes feminist values, anti-capitalist values, values that promote introspection rather than manic social values of the sort that you see alcohol promoting. It would make an immense change in the architecture of the culture.
Who deciphered the Voynich manuscript?
For $25,000? for those of you who don't know what the question is about, it refers to a very interesting manuscript that I've written about that is an unread or unreadable book. It's written in an unknown language. No other example of this language has ever been found. And the CIA spent a lot of time trying to decipher this book because it's at least 500 years old, and it drove them bonkers to believe that modern code-cracking machinery could not deal with a medieval manuscript. I mean, modern code-making is orders of magnitude more sophisticated than anything that the 14th or 15th century possessed. So they spent a lot of money trying to understand this code and essentially failed. Now, very recently, a gentleman on the East Coast named Dr. Leo Levitov, and this is the answer to the question, Leo Levitov, wrote a book called The Solution to the Voynich Manuscript. And he has, he believes, figured out what it is. And the reason the CIA couldn't decipher it, according to Levitov, is because it was never encrypted in the first place. He says it isn't an encrypted manuscript, it's an artificial alphabet being used to write down a rural form of polyglot medieval Flemish with a huge number of Old French and Old High German loan words. So there you have it, folks.
Do you know if Illinois bunchweed, is it bunchweed or bundleweed? I think it's bundleweed.
Bundleweed. Mm-hmm.
Is available from any commercial nursery?
I believe it's available from Of the Jungle in Sebastopol, California. I'm not their sales rep, so I don't keep weekly track on their inventory, but I believe it's available from Of the Jungle.
Call information.
Yeah.
What future modifications to the Time Wave software are ideally in store?
Oh, what a great question. Well, the Time Wave software is being put out both in an MS-DOS version and a Mac version, and they're both pretty flashy, and in a sense that finishes the program of bringing to the public the Time Wave in its raw and sort of naked form. What we're moving on to now is sort of a game, which would be a time travel simulator. It would be created in an immersive technology. This phrase, immersive technology, now replaces previous buzzwords, virtual reality. Dump that. Only outsiders call it that now. It's called immersive technology. And the idea is to build in a CD-ROM environment, a huge visual database to accompany the Time Wave. And then the Time Wave could easily be configured into a game where, in a certain historical period, if you encountered some difficulty and you mastered it, you would be catapulted forward one resonance. And the idea would be to move from the Big Bang to the transcendental object at the end of time and beat out the competition. And it's a very sly way. I mean, I'm not big on products or games, but it's a very sly way of teaching people history. And you could make so many paths through the data that the game would never play the same way twice, or it would take thousands of times to do that. And a lot of talent seems to have come forward for this. So that looms.
What happened to your theory about change versus non-change and the cataclysmic events to come? Did that become the time wave continuum?
Yeah, that's right. I referred to this a little earlier when I was talking about how business as usual is off the menu and all these curves are converging. I really believe that the core insight for me of the psychedelic experience, and I believe that it is objectively real, is the discovery that history is a finite phenomenon of some sort. It began 8,000 years ago, and it will end at some point in the future. Well, that's not terribly upsetting or challenging unless one specifies at what point in the future. And I maintain, for reasons most of which are too complicated to go into here, that it is about 20 years in the future, that the planet can no longer sustain us. We can no longer create any kind of existence that we could consider humane, and that technology, population, the way in which psychedelics are stimulating the imagination, the way in which culture generally is driving the imagination, that we are on the brink of being able to design ourselves and place ourselves into a new world of some sort. And I'm vague on the details. It's not outer space. It's not, some kind of a managed Orwellian collectivist paradise. It's something more profound than that. We are perhaps going to download ourselves into a gold ytterbium cube that we will super cool and bury 1,000 feet beneath Copernicus, and there all walk on the virtual beaches barefoot and alive. I don't know. But what is happening here at the end of the 20th century, you see, is a kind of birth process. Think of the fetal life in the womb. You're endlessly adrift in the amniotic ocean, weightless. Food and oxygen are being delivered without even your awareness through the umbilical cord. It is paradise. And if you were there and you were in control of your fate, you would choose to prolong it forever. But what happens instead is that you get squeezed into the birth canal. Then the paradise turns into hell. Strangulation, pressure. You are literally being squeezed to death. To ask the fetus at that point to conceive of the wonderful, satisfying life that it is going to have 40 years hence as a stockbroker living in Bel Air and collecting minor works of Cubist art is ridiculous. Because, that's not where we're at the moment. And so I believe that culturally we are in the birth canal, and everything appears to be being destroyed. The oceans, the atmosphere, the very integrity of our own bodies because of all these diseases, ideological contamination, you name it. But we simply must push forward. It's a forward escape. We can never go back, to the game-dotted plains of archaic Africa. That's gone. It's all gone. The only way out is forward. It's called a forward escape. And I'm interested in propagating this notion because, number one, I believe it, and number two, it is a message of hope without which I think people are going to be very challenged, because things are going to get worse, apparently much worse. I mean, it would not cause me to break stride if the mess in Bosnia spread until it stretched from the Arctic Circle to Turkey and from Vienna to Vladivostok. I mean, those people are setting themselves up for hell on earth, and we will be dragged into it in some fashion, even if we only have to witness it. So history is turning into a white-knuckle ride, for sure. And without the faith in some kind of transcendental phase transition, I think there's a tendency to despair and to panic and to nihilism. And religion has failed. You know, what religion gives us is what we saw last week in Texas. They can only conceive of phase transition as apocalypse, as Ragnarok, the twilight of the gods. That isn't what it is. We are closing distance with the first moments of true human civilization. You know, when people actually do treat each other with respect, when there actually is a place made for the celebration of human differences, when we actually do feel the suffering of the people around us and respond to that. So without psychedelics and the models that they make possible, hope is, I think, a very, very fragile thing. And that's why I take the position that I do, because I think that we are on the brink of the adventure for which we left the trees and left the African plain. But it's not a sure thing. It rests in our hands, as it always has. I mean, remember that in the last million years, 9 times the ice has moved south from the poles, miles high, pushing before it our ancestors, people wrapped in skin, naked as jaybirds, marginal as can be, no antibiotics, no global weather forecasting, no nothing. And they didn't drop the ball. They survived. They took care of their children and their elderly. They passed the skills and the technologies and the insights and the songs down the long stream of time. Can we do any less? We who have in our hands the power to shape the planet for good or evil, we who can communicate with each other globally in a moment, it would be a pretty sad commentary on the notion of cultural progress and intelligence if they could keep the faith and we can't. So it all went for this. It will all be made clear in the lifetime of most of us. And so I just want to sort of close on that note, invite you to keep the faith, invite you to explore the edges, and to make of yourself a vessel, a conduit for the world-transforming logos that is trying to speak to all of us to create a sane and viable and celebratory world for our children and their children. Thank you very much.
Terrence Kemp McKenna. Here's to you, my friend. Hi, everybody. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Hope you all enjoyed that. True Hallucinations. Terrence McKenna. He was a wonderful man, born in 1946, died April 3rd, 2000, and was reborn on that same day. Alright, let's take a break here. I need to play some music. A little bit of schmungel for you here. This is called Dorset Perception. And take a chill pill, alright? It's nice and long. I'll talk to you soon. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. On the web, kopn.org. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, that's Spangle. It's called Dorset Perception. It's Mike, you're listening to Radio Orbit, and it's good to be with you all here. Just a few minutes before 1 a.m. now on April 3rd, 2007. Happy spring to y'all. I was wondering what to do for this last hour. Didn't prepare anything, but if you'd like to call in and talk about anything that you just heard or anything else for that matter. A couple people online talking about UFO experiences and visionary plant experiences that they've had. Welcome to talk about any of that stuff if you'd like. You can post a question up there on the website or call me, 573-443-8255. That's the phone number if you want to talk on the air here.
And I'll grab the phone once I have access to the thing.
Okay, there we go. There's the phone. Anyway, and, well, great stuff. True Hallucinations, Terrence McKenna. The amazing story of him and his brother Dennis. And the absolute, you know, just strangeness that was unleashed in the Amazon in 1971. March 4th and 5th, 1971. And if you'd like to hear that, go to the archives in a day or so. All right, we'll have it up there. All right, let's take a few phone calls, see if anybody wants to talk, and then we'll do some poetry and some other stuff in a little while. All right. Radio Orbit, hello, who's this?
This is Matt.
Hi, Matt, how's it going?
Good.
What's going on?
Not much. Just calling in and talk to Mike. Is this Mike?
It is.
Hey, Mike. It's Matt Presti.
Oh, Matt. Hi. Pleasure to talk to you.
You too.
What do you think?
I think it's a great show. I love Terrence very much.
Yeah, me too. No question about it. He was a special guy, and we're fortunate to have been exposed to him. You know, it's amazing. He touched a whole lot of people, but not as many as he should, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Can I ask you a personal question real quick?
Sure.
I've heard you talk many times that Terrence was a personal friend of yours. Mm-hmm. Can you just give me a little background on how personal and how you met him, and
uh-huh.
a little bit of background?
Yeah. About 1993 or so, maybe 94, 93 actually, it was sort of the early days of the internet, you know what I mean? There wasn't a whole lot of websites and all that stuff yet, but there was these early, you know now how we use forums and bulletin boards and all that stuff?
Right.
The early sort of incarnation of that were these things that were called Usenet groups. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but you
yes.
know, so there were these Usenet groups, and there was one that that evolved or that was created that was called the Novelty Group. And somehow, I don't know how exactly, I got turned on to that, and I joined the group, and it was basically just a pretty small number of people, maybe 10 or 12 people, that were discussing novelty theory and the ideas, you know, that were brought out in Invisible Landscape and True Hallucinations and the stuff that that Terrence had put out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Terrence would visit this group pretty frequently. In fact, he was a part of it. So we were always, everybody was conversing back and forth, and Terrence would always respond to the discussions or whatever. Maybe not every day or something, but you know, we were all posting a lot. But he would post whenever he decided it was, you know, relevant or whatever. Eventually, we began a dialogue. A personal dialogue, just over email, right?
Awesome.
And then, from then on, it was just, became friends. That's all. You know.
You get to meet him personally, like Venus.
As a matter of fact, yeah. And
awesome.
And I saw him just last night. As a matter of fact, too.
Okay.
So he's around. He's hanging around. He doesn't look quite exactly like he did before. He takes the shape of a raven these days, believe it or not. And I mean this seriously. You can take it as serious as you like. But anyway, that's a wild story. I'll tell it off the air, or I'll tell it after you and I get off the phone here. The story of why I think that. Anything else on your mind? Matt, by the way, everybody, is a songwriter and a producer and a writer and a musician in the St. Louis area who has written some wonderful stuff that we play on the program sometimes. There's a great song. You have a lot of great stuff, but one that I get a lot of requests for is called Shine, and I want to thank you for sharing your music with us, Matt. It's great.
Yeah, I appreciate it very much for playing it, and I got it. Send a shout out real quick to Crux for turning me on to your show, because without him it wouldn't have been possible. So.
All right, well, you're doing great stuff, and I look forward to going. I know you got a new link up that you sent me an email to go listen to some other stuff. I haven't had a chance yet, but I promise I will.
That's cool. I put a little Terrence McKenna over some original music I did.
Right on.
It's kind of a tribute for him, so. It's myspace.com/MATTPRESTI.
All right, myspace/MattPresti.
Absolutely.
All right, Matt, thanks, man. Take care of yourself, all right?
Hey, you too, bro.
All right, I'll
keep
talk to you soon.
Good work.
You bet. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
All right, thanks, Matt, for the phone call. And all right, so you don't think I'm crazy. What happened was in the year 2000, 7 years ago today, essentially. Yes, exactly now, because we're already on April 3rd. So I might as well tell a story. The novelty group that I talked about to Matt was still, and is to this day, actually, still in existence. I don't participate there for the most part anymore. But back then, 7 years ago, it was still really active. And there was a project that had been undertaken to raise money for Terrence and his family, because for those of you who are unfamiliar with the ending of Terrence's earthly story, at least, he developed a strange and rare type of brain cancer, which was eventually something that he was not able to overcome. And so he died on April 3rd of the year 2000. Well, before his death, this gang of people over there at the Novelty Group, and Ron Lloyd, I want to thank him personally for his wonderful work and all the other artists that were involved in it, but they created a CD that was called Journey Through the Spheres. And the idea was to sell it and raise money for Terrence and try to, you know, help him and his family with this whole cancer situation that he was in the middle of, because, you know, he didn't have insurance and all that. So anyway, I was very proud of him and everything, and was, you know, watched the whole thing as it all developed. I didn't actually participate I didn't donate any music or anything to the project, but I certainly discussed it often and at length with, you know, the people involved, and we all sort of built it together, and it was awesome. And I've given away a few copies of that on the air, and I'll give away another one tonight in a little while, since I think I have a couple copies of it. So anyway, so back then it was the morning of April 3rd. And I was sleeping, and I had a dream. I had this remarkable dream. I don't know, you know, middle of the night, 3 in the morning. And in my dream, the novelty group, a bunch of the folks from the novelty group, were all assembled at my house in Denver. I was living at Denver, in Denver at the time. And everyone was there, and I knew everyone. Somehow, even though we were only conversing for the most part online, you know, everyone seemed to have the right face and everything. So anyway, we were all in my living room, and we were all chatting and talking about Terrence and all this stuff. And on the counter, on the kitchen counter, was a stack of orders for the CD, for Journey Through the Spheres. It was sort of a celebratory party because we had finished the CD, and, you know, he had all these orders that were ready, and we're going to be able to raise some money for T and his family. So anyway, this is what was going on there in the dream. And in the middle of this whole scene, and it was very celebratory, there's drinking and partying and whooping it up. And, you know, I remember this girl Krista was in the dream, who to this day posts over there on the novelty list. And she's a beautiful young woman, and has a nice young daughter, and I wish her the best, and all the people that, you know, were a part of that whole scene, regardless of, you know, where you've gone, what's happened to you. It was a wonderful group, and I was privileged to be a part of it. I learned a lot from those people. So, anyway, in the middle of this party scene, in my dream, all of a sudden, in through the window, flies a raven. A big crow, you know, and lands on my shoulder, begins to talk to me, and it's Terrence, speaking to me clearly. You know, I mean, you know how clear he was able to speak, clearly speaking to me, and the details of which I'm, you know, not willing to really discuss. But at any rate, that went on, and next thing you know, out the window, the raven flew, and that was, you know, the party continued, but that was basically the end of the dream. Nothing else remarkable happened. except when I woke up. I was working for a company called U.S. Medical at the time, in the medical distribution business, capital equipment, selling x-rays and lasers and all kinds of silly technology that's supposed to heal people, most time hurts them. And I would get up in the morning pretty early and get to work. So I had a dog at the time. My dog's name was Elwood, and he was a Labrador Retriever, yellow Labrador, great dog, and very old though. He died in 2002, and he was 16 when he died. So in the year 2000, he was 14 years old, and you know, in good health for a dog his age, but you know, not running around and stuff like that. You know, had a hard time getting out the damn door. So anyway, every morning we would go for a walk before I went to work, and it was a short walk. You couldn't go very far. So we would just, like, walk down to the end of the block, then cross the street, and then walk back down on the other side of the block, and then cross back over at our house. So this morning, April 3rd, 2000, we did that, and went down to the end of the block, turned, went across the street, and as we were walking back, now towards our house, but on the other side of the street, my dog, Elwood, just stopped and sat down. You know, he never had a leash or anything like that, and he just sat down on the sidewalk, and I was like, "Come on," you know, and he wouldn't move, and I was a few steps ahead of him, so he just sat there. And I walked back and petted him and said, "What are you doing?" And you know, there's no one out at this time of the morning. It was a cold day in April at 6 in the morning. And the street was abandoned, you know, and it was just, you know, getting light and all that. And he cocked his head up. And sitting in this tree right above us, maybe 10 feet above us, was this raven sitting there looking right at me and Elwood, and you know, no other birds or nothing. It was, surreal, you know, and after I had this dream, it was surreal and very strange, one of those weird moments where, you know, time just gets sort of warped and you feel like you're in the middle of something that's much stranger than you imagined, you know. So anyway, I was astonished, and after the recognition, after we looked at each other, then the crow just off and flew away. Me and my dog kept going, walked back home, and I went to work. And at about 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock that morning at work, I went and I checked email and did my website stuff that I always used to do, and I got noticed that Terrence had died that morning. He died at like 2 o'clock in the morning or something on April 3rd. So sort of, you know, right around the time at least that I was having this amazing dream and then saw this raven in the morning. And since then, I've had more reason to believe, you know, that he's still here and still with us. And his work is almost done, I think. We're going to find out. But anyway, he was the best, and can't say enough about him. And I love Dennis, too, and Dennis is, he's awesome, and he's doing great work in his own way. And I hope that we'll have him back on the program sometime in the summer. Like I said, we spoke last Wednesday, and he's real busy, but we'll definitely get him back on the air. He's glad to talk when he can. Okay. All right. Let's see. The flying saucer is an image of the perfected human mind, waiting, warmly humming at the end of human history on this planet. Ian writes this in the chat room, and that's a quote that Terrence had said. Terrence was a lot like Carl Jung in his belief of what the flying saucer was about. He believed that it was an element of the superego, essentially of the human psyche, but at the same time understood that just because something is a denizen of the psyche does not mean that it cannot have efficacious force in three-dimensional reality. In other words, they are real. They are real. But they are a product of the oversoul, of the human psyche, an archetypal image of perfection, the mandala, floating without the bind of gravity. Carl Jung said that the only thing that we really know of that defies gravity is consciousness, the human psyche, the mind. It's anti-gravity in its truest form. Let's take another phone call here. Yeah, the number's working, and Ian, you're welcome to call. 573-443-8255. 573-443-8255. KOPN Columbia, it's Radio Orbit. Hello, who's this?
This is Ian.
Oh, Ian, hi, how are you?
How's it going, Mike?
Pretty good, nice to talk with you.
All right, and I get to actually see the real-time delay here.
Yeah, you better turn off your computer feed or something.
Cool. Are you down to talk about UFO experience?
Sure. What do you want to talk about? You mentioned online that you'd like to talk about experiences. I know you've had at least one, but why don't you tell us about it?
Well, I was living, you're familiar with Lawrence, Kansas.
Lawrence, Kansas? Sure, sure.
Yeah, I lived in Kansas City at the time, and I was actually going to school in Lawrence, Kansas at KU, and I was driving on the highway one night.
Uh-huh.
And a huge flash of light shined right in my eye, like uh-huh. directly in my eye and blinded me. I'm going 70 miles an hour on the highway.
From above or what?
Yeah, it was up above. It was in the sky, not too far off, but it was really just a ball of light.
Uh-huh.
Basically. And, well, let's see here. It turned into this faint little ball, and it shot off, and it was gone. So I thought, you know, no problem. This is just a light in the sky, you know. You see, it's strange, but, you know, it's hard to say what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Next
mm-hmm.
night, I'm on my roof with my girlfriend at the time, and I'm talking about what I saw on the highway the night before, mm-hmm. and this huge purple light flashes in the sky, mm-hmm. deep purple, violet, kind of like the violet color of certain spores.
Right.
And went to a faint little ball and was gone. We both saw it. I thought it was very strange.
Mm-hmm.
The very next night, I'm on the roof again with another friend of mine. I talk about the two nights. I see two balls of light appear right over us, right as I'm talking about it, and they're gone. So, no big deal. Some lights in the sky, that's fine.
Time frame. When was this?
This is the summer of 97.
97, okay.
So then, the very last night, I fell asleep at my girlfriend's house, and I thought, I got up in the middle of the night and said, I got to get out of here. I hope I don't see some UFOs or something crazy. And as I'm driving, you know, I'm at her parents' house. There's, like, this field. It's open. And I'm driving, and I see this black ship flying parallel with my car. And I look over at it, and I immediately hit the brakes. My car comes to a complete stop, and this object stops at the exact moment my car stops. So I'm sitting there thinking to myself, what is this? I turned on my window. It's not making any noise, and there's just these flashing lights, kind of like what you described earlier tonight.
And it was still in the sky, though, but above you.
This was parallel with me. It was about 30 feet to my left. I'm just sitting on in the street looking at this thing. It's not making any noise. It's just perfectly just sitting there observing me, basically.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering to myself, okay, you know, I was freaking out at the time.
What shape was it? Were you able to make out a shape?
Well, to me, the way the lights were situated, it looked like a triangle.
Hmm.
But it was kind of parallel with me, so I couldn't really tell. So then at that moment, I see some headlights pop up, come in my direction, the opposite direction. I'm just sitting in the street looking at this thing, and I'm thinking to myself, somebody else is going to see this, and they're going to freak out.
Hmm.
And right as I thought this, it flew backwards behind the tree. This car goes by, and then it flies back and just sits there and looks at me. And it's hard to describe the sensations coming over me at that time. Then it flew down to the ground. And I tried to drive around to where it was to see what it was. And the next thing I knew, I had this overwhelming sensation where Kent described it on the forum, this tingling sensation where I thought I was just going to lose my mind. And I looked above me, and it was a perfect equilateral triangle. And I was never the same again. And it led me on this path to seek what was going on. Terrence spoke about UFO experiences. You spoke about UFO experiences, and you said his work is almost done here. As you know, the UFO, he had many theories that it was ourselves in the future, or the archetypes, as you mentioned.
Yeah, yeah. I just have a feeling that something like that is going on. You know, the reason that I say it is because that idea was basically that there was, in other words, this is what Jung thought, right? He said that something existed in the human psyche that was like a governor or a thermostat, that when the race got to a point where it was dangerous to itself and no longer able to successfully, you know, cohabit the planet with the other species, where it became, you know, dangerous to itself and everybody else, that this governor, this thermostat kicks in, and then what it does is it throws out archetypal images from the superego, from the collective unconscious, that will invalidate the power structures of the day, right? In other words, the idea would be that the UFO, now don't get me wrong, who knows what the triangles are and all this stuff. There's a very good chance that there are earthly craft, you know, that are made by men.
The way that this object moves, I came across a passage, I don't know if you are familiar with Jocelyn Godwin, wrote a book called The Polar Myth, but basically he was breaking down what he called, Tibetans called manisolas, that actually move like conscious beings themselves. And the object that I saw was definitely not somebody was holding a steering wheel on this thing. It was like it was its own entity all on its own.
Amazing. Well, I mean, this stuff is so mysterious. It's gotten really muddy, but, you know, let me finish the thought about the Jungian idea. First of all, the idea that he thought was happening was that something would be introduced into the culture that would make people think differently about what was going on, right? And so the idea that if a saucer, you know, this circle, and he was very interested in the circular form, and he related it to the mandala and the idea of the soul as a circle, right? And the idea would be that the saucer itself would invalidate the current belief systems that were happening. In other words, science, you know, if the saucers, you know, were called down and were hanging over Washington, D.C., and nobody could do anything about it, you know what I mean? It would make people realize that the people that they consider in power and in control are not in control, right? And they're not in power. And so it basically depotentiates the situation, and then something new is able to arise, right? Because
that's exactly what happened to me.
Uh-huh.
At that point, I woke up to so many things, and I looked at the world. I would never see it the same way, and I wouldn't be talking to you right now had this not happened to me. It was such a, you know, meaningful moment in my life.
Well, see, I think what's happening is that there are individuals who have had these experiences, and what's going to happen, who knows when, but I think what's going to happen is that pretty soon everyone's going to see it. In other words, it's going to happen, you know, where nobody can deny it. In other words, right now, it's the scientific establishment looks at individual people and says, well, you, Ian, because of the experience that you report, you must be invalidated, okay? Your personal experience, your firsthand data is no good to them. They tell you that you are sick, you are confused, you are misinformed, you are, you know, just in need of help.
Attention.
Right? Attention of some sort. And
on the radio.
Right. So what you're supposed to do as an individual who's had a unique experience, the current paradigm tells you that your experience is no good. It's not valid. And that you are crazy or something else. So your question to yourself is, well, do I believe my own firsthand experience and take it through my own consciousness, through my own intelligence, and make what I will make of it? Or am I just going to believe some bullshit dictate laid on from above, you know? And
nope, and that it gave me that conviction that I knew exactly what happened to me.
That's right.
And no matter what words I may choose on the radio here, it doesn't really matter, but I know what happened to me. And I know what kind of an impact it had on me, and no matter what anybody may say about it, it doesn't matter.
Right.
So
right.
It validated my own experience for myself and invalidated so many things around me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what Terrence and Dennis were up to in the Amazon all those years ago, and what they actually thought was going to happen at the end of the experiment was that essentially they would do exactly that. In other words, right now, the UFO experience, a UFO experience like the ones that we're talking about, right, that are transformative experiences, right? Right now, they're sort of random, and they sort of seem to pop up at different points in time for different people, and nobody knows where, when, or why, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what Terrence and Dennis had in mind was that it could be done at will. It could be brought on, and it could be controlled, right? So imagine if somebody could actually do that, call down the saucers, and
you know what, Mike, and I've had experiences where I thought that I could do that, and for some reason, in the back of my mind, I have this feeling that it could be done. I may not have gotten there yet,
uh-huh. But
the potential, I think, could be done.
Well, I think that...
Obviously, you're tracking something as well.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think it can be done. I think it can be done, too. And I think that it has to be done. I think that it has to be done. Or we are in deep, deep doo-doo. Because something has got to shift the gears of the way things are happening on this planet. And it's not going to be political, you know. It's not going to be... It's very hard to envision a grassroots thing that actually gets enough steam behind it unless something can catalyze it. And I think that the catalyst is something like the flying saucer. I've yet to be able to think of another event, a paradigm shifting event that could in one fell swoop make the shift happen. You know what I mean? And that's the one that I think of. But I don't think it's going to be contact with aliens or anything like that. I do believe that it is probably essentially something that's being created through the Gaian mind and our own minds, but it does take physical form. But I think that it's us somehow. And I don't see us talking to gray-faced aliens. I see the thing hanging over Washington, D.C., you know, just hanging there saying, come on, where's your fancy weapons? Where's your, what are you going to do? How are you going to deny me now? You know what I mean? And it's not going to be some benevolent space brother or anything like that. It's going to be something that's utterly mysterious and remains mysterious and shows people that there still is mystery and that nobody knows what's going on. And these people that tell you that they do are actually charlatans, right? And that's what I think, I don't know when, I'd love to see it happen tonight, you know, in honor of our friend. But whenever it happens, it's going to blow their heads, you know. And well, it should, because people need to get their lenses opened a little bit. If yeah. We're going to make it as a species.
Definitely not.
You know,
keep calm them down.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, you know, I encourage everyone to do that. You know, right now, let's try an experiment, everybody. Whoever's listening, okay, in honor of our good friend, Terrence McKenna, and all of our other ancestors, and all of the other wonderful men and women who have come before us, and have, you know, gone through tremendous amounts of difficulty to get us here. Like Terrence said before, we are not going to drop the ball. We are not going to crap on our ancestors any longer. So right now, all right, let's do it. We got a half hour left. For the next half hour, concentrate. Bring them down. Call them down and lay these jerks out for what they are. Now is the time. Everything's it's time to come out. You know, 9/11, it's time. It's time for all this stuff to be done. And let's see it written all over the sky. Let's see it written all over the sky. All right? So whoever's out there listening, call down the saucers. Now is as good a time as any, right?
Nope.
All right.
Ian, amen, brother.
I love you, brother. Take care of yourself.
Take care.
All right, cheers. All right, everybody, it's 1:30 in the morning. It's Mike. You're listening to KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. On the web, kopn.org, and Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. It's a piece of music from our friends Spangl. On the web, Spangl, SHPONGLE.org, and you can find them linked up at my site as well, okay? This one's called Spangl Spores. We'll talk a little bit about mushrooms maybe when we come back, all right? It's Mike, you listen to KOPN Radio Orbit. Back in a few.
All right, everybody, that's Spangl. The song is called Spangl Spores. These guys are great. Good music from the United Kingdom, and you listen to it here on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's Mike, and we're back at you here. What time is it? About 20 until 2, 22 minutes before the hour of 2 a.m. on the 3rd of April, and we're calling down the saucers tonight, people. And Terrence McKenna is our inspiration for our invocation. 2:15 a.m. Pacific time is when he actually joined the ancestors. And that makes it 4:15 a.m. our time here in Missouri. So that's about 2.5 hours from now, a little bit more than that, 2 hours and 35 minutes or so from now. So stay up. Concentrate, meditate, pray, do everything you can do. Call upon your ancestors and tell them to help you pull this off, all right? We want to call down the saucers. New York City, how about that? Right above New York City. Washington, D.C., right there too. Chicago, that's because I'm from there. We'll hang one there for a while. Let's see. Vancouver for Dennis. All right? Let him know everything's cool. South Dakota, Pine Ridge, and Hopi Land, Arizona. There are 6 places for the 6 directions. How about that? Bring them on in. Bring it on, as they say. All right? Bring it on. Okay, we're going to bring it on. You got 2.5 hours. All right? And then at the moment of Terrence's 7th anniversary of his passing, we'll call down the saucers tonight. You know, when Ian and I were talking, I wanted to make a distinction about, you know, man-made objects or otherwise. And I think there's some evidence to say that there are some pretty funky things that are flying around out there that have been made by human hands. But in the early UFO days, I think that there was a legitimate concern on the part of the governments of the world, essentially. I mean, I think there was legitimate concern in the U.S. government and confusion over what was happening. And I think there's quite a bit of evidence to show that they didn't know what was happening. And there were, you know, there's correspondence back and forth between European nations and the U.S., you know, that said, you know, what is this business about these flying saucers and la la la. And they were showing up on radar. And there's documentation of that, you know. And in 1952, there was this wild event that happened over the skies, over the city, I should say, of Washington, D.C. And it was a big deal. There were all kinds of lights zipping around in the sky at night over the Capitol. And unless this is all just a gigantic ruse that's been, you know, concocted up by people since, you know, who knows when. And I recognize that as a possibility. I just don't think it's a probability. I think there's general confusion. I think there was a very legitimate concern among government officials and military people that they didn't know what the hell was going on. They may have eventually then, you know, manipulated it and began to use it, you know, to their own advantage. In other words, if the UFO just shows up randomly but never does anything, you know, and you observe this for a while and you realize, well, we don't know what they are, but they don't seem to be doing anything, you know, well then why not use their image? Why not use them for your own agenda? Because they're not doing anything, but they seem to be real. So create a story that they're yours or something. And then, you know, in the meantime, they're probably creating their own technology. But I don't think they've got anything like this UFO thing, like the flying saucer. They move in a very strange manner, and they do things that, you know, defy physics, supposedly, as we know it. Which is the whole point, to invalidate science. The scientific paradigm has led us to the brink of global catastrophe. We have nuclear weapons stockpiled like cordwood. We've got
biological weapons, chemical weapons, you know, space-based stuff, who knows what, and the planet is in peril. We have environmental problems that are, you know, reaching a point where who knows how long the system can sustain itself. And something has got to give. And we are either going to be thrown back to the Stone Age, or we are going to have an archaic revival in which we incorporate some wisdom into the monkey technology and the wielding of it, or we are going to blow ourselves and a whole bunch of others to bits. And I don't want to see that happen. So, what's the answer? Spangle spores. That's what Terence would tell you. That's psilocybin, the mushroom at the end of history, is not going to be a mushroom cloud. The mushroom cloud is representative of what's going to happen to this paradigm that we're at the end of. It's going to be blown to smithereens by the flying saucer, by the mushroom, and through the hearts and the minds and the hands of people who are working, you know, for the betterment of humanity. People that are honestly trying to move forward the brotherhood and the sisterhood of humankind. You know, this psilocybin report from Johns Hopkins that came out last June or July, we talked about it on the air a lot and stuff, you know. It was a big deal. And it's amazing that it's been a year almost since that was released. And in this town, for example, in Colombia, right, there has not been one story. I have not heard one doctor talk about it. I have not heard, you know, any university people discuss this. I mean, Johns Hopkins, you know, is supposed to be, if not the most respected, certainly one of the most respected medical schools in the country. And they clearly showed the benefits of psilocybin. And so the cat's out of the sack, you know, essentially, and it has been for some time, but now it's official because you've got doctors and a great body now of research and data that cannot be denied. Just like the UFO hanging over your head cannot be denied. And, you know, with regard to psychology and psychiatry, I mean, my gosh, we are ignoring and denying people who need help because of this disastrous situation that we have created for ourselves in this, you know, this desolate culture of ours where people are broken and left to crumble. Well, people need help. You want to help them? Well, the first thing the psychiatrist should do and the psychologist should do is take some of their own damn medicine. They prescribe stuff for these people that, you know, make your hair twist. Would they take it? No. Want shock therapy? Would you give yourself shock therapy, Mr. Doctor? Probably not. So, you know, maybe they should, you know, take heed and, you know, look at the advice of the Hopkins study and maybe start doing some bioassays of their own. You know, before you start telling other people how to straighten out their own lives, maybe you should straighten out your own damn life before you start giving advice and drugs. You know, start doing research right here on psilocybin. Why isn't it happening in our progressive community? Johns Hopkins did it. Where are you, Missouri? University of Missouri? Where are you? Silent. Just like the newspapers and all these clowns that call themselves journalists. Whatever. Cannot stop what's happening. All right. 10 minutes or so. And I just want to say thanks to everybody for listening to the show. We'll play another piece of music here at the end of the program. Kent Stedman, next week, and we haven't talked to the Bard for quite some time, so we'll do it next week. And he's the best. Talk about UFO experiences. He's got one posted up on his on the front page of Orbit right now. That is his, you know, his personal experience that some other people have talked about and have been writing about over on the forum. But anyway, Kent's had some amazing experiences of his own that maybe we'll talk a little bit about next week. And we can also talk next week with Kent about all the wild flying saucer stories that are going to start to pop out this morning at 4:15 a.m. because of all the wonderful concentration, focus, and meditational work that we're all going to do between now and then. Right? Remember, New York City, Washington, D.C., Chicago, Illinois, Vancouver, British Columbia, Pine Ridge, South Dakota, and Hopi Land. After that, just let them fly wild wherever they want. All right. So, happy days. And Terrence, happy birthday, my friend. I love you. And one of these days we'll see you again. It's Mike. You have been listening to Radio Orbit. We'll come back next week with Kent. Check him out in the meantime, www.cyberspaceorbit.com. And my website, by the way, is MikeHagan, HAGAN.com. And you can check us all out at KOPN.org. And KOPN does wonderful stuff throughout the day and throughout the week. And you can listen to the stream anytime, whether I'm on the air or not, KOPN.org. And I encourage you all to check out the radio station and try to support the station if you can. There's one last phone call here, so I guess I'll grab this and I'm going to say hello, and welcome to Orbit. Who's this?
This is Deborah.
Hi, Deborah.
I'm outside. I've been outside most of the evening at a bonfire under the moon, just out on my pond. And when you said about the saucer, I'm on my porch, and I'm sitting on this round shadow, and it's black, and it's got a white center, and it's moon shining through the lattice on my porch.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sitting on this round disc, and I just thought it's down on the ground. It's not up in the sky.
Hmm.
I can see the stars and everything. Can you hear the chimes that are blowing?
I can. The wind chimes. I hear them. And you know what? It is a full moon, as you mentioned. And
the full moon
right.
shining
and
right here.
So it's a good night for magic. You know what I mean? So
yeah, well, it's making this big round circle that's about 3 feet, and I'm sitting in the middle of it in this diagonal lattice is here.
All right.
So it's a shadow pattern of contrasting light and dark.
Well, send that image right back up in the sky, okay?
I just see stars and a big moon. Okay, I just to say hi.
Thank you, Deborah. Take care of yourself, all right?
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, everybody, it's Mike, Radio Orbit, one last time. Thanks for listening. We'll get back to you next week with the man himself, Kent Stedman, the Bard of CyberspaceOrbit.com. In the meantime, take care of yourselves. Enjoy the night. Go outside in 2 hours and 21 minutes. Look up at the stars and see what else you see up there. You'll see a full moon and maybe some spinning ancestral souls that morph themselves into flying saucers to save humanity. How about it? All right, Spangle, a new way to say hooray. How about that as well? Mike Hagan, Radio Orbit. Talk to you next week.
Assume a third toke, long and slow. You vaporize, and you take it in and in and in, and there is a sound like the crumpling of a plastic bread wrapper, or the crackling, or the playing, and a tone. And a a tone, a and there is this, and there is this. There is a cheer. The gnomes have learned a new way to say who.
moving with energy, but that is not what immediately arrests my attention. What arrests my attention is the fact that this space is inhabited.